It's 4 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
A meeting over ceasefire in eastern Ukraine ends in disagreement. I'm Joe Palca reporting. A meeting of the foreign ministers of Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France ended today in a disagreement over who's to blame for violations of the ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius addressed reporters.
We, the four ministers, call for the strict implementation of all provisions of the Minsk agreements, starting from a comprehensive ceasefire and withdrawal of heavy weapons. We call upon the earliest possible conclusion of the plans for withdrawal of heavy weapons and their full implementation.
Ukrainian Foreign Minister Pavlo Klimkin pointed out that the ministers did not reach agreement on who's to blame for the current breaking of the ceasefire agreement. Speaking today before a U.S. Senate committee, Secretary of State John Kerry said that Russia has repeatedly lied to him about its activities in Ukraine.
They have been persisting in their misrepresentations, lies, whatever you want to call them, about their activities there to my face, to the face of others, on many different occasions.
For more on this story, visit our website at voanews.com. Activists say Islamic State militants have kidnapped at least 90 Assyrian Christians during raids in northeastern Syria. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said scores of people were abducted after fighting ended in the Khabur area of Hasaka province on Monday. IS fighters have routinely targeted religious and ethnic minorities using kidnappings and killings in their quest for territorial expansion across Syria and Iraq. This is VOA News. A suicide bombing has killed at least 10 people in the Nigerian city of Kano. Reports from Kano say the bombing happened late Tuesday at the Kano Line bus station. Nigeria's Daily Trust newspaper reports two men detonated explosives shortly after boarding a vehicle headed for Jigawa. The blast came just hours after an explosion struck a location in the town of Patiskum. At least 17 people were killed and dozens of others were wounded. A new licensing agreement with the pharmaceutical company Merck allows for the manufacturer of a generic version of a pediatric AIDS drug. It may be 2 years before it's readily available in low- and middle-income countries. However, it's a step toward having greater access to HIV medicines specifically designed for children. VOA's Joe DiCapuo reports.
It's estimated there are more than 3 million children living with HIV, but less than a third of them received antiretroviral therapy in 2013. The Merck drug, raltegravir, has been approved for children as young as 4 weeks. Medicine's patent pool executive director, Greg Perry, says pediatric AIDS drugs are a neglected area of health care. As a result, many kids with HIV are forced to take adult formulations.
The children won't take them. So there's a whole series of problems with using adult formulations. And finally, worst of all, of course, is that when you try and break them down, they're not really perfectly digestible.
Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
It's estimated that 700 children are newly infected each day, while 500 die of AIDS-related causes. Eurozone finance ministers today approved a four-month extension of Greece's $270 billion debt bailout arrangement after Greek authorities promised to carry out more financial reforms. National parliaments in Europe's 19-nation euro currency bloc must still give their approval. The vote is expected Friday in Germany. U.S. President Barack Obama has vetoed the Keystone XL pipeline project. The White House sent notice of the veto to the Senate today. Here is presidential spokesman Josh Earnest.
The reason the president will veto this legislation that has passed the Congress is that it circumvents a long-standing administrative process for evaluating whether or not infrastructure projects like this are in the best interest of the country. And it does not represent a specific position on the pipeline itself.
Earlier this year, the Republican-led Congress approved the bill for the construction of the pipeline. Britain has become the first country in the world to allow the creation of human embryos from the DNA of three people rather than just two. Scientists have developed the technique to help mothers avoid passing on genetically degenerative diseases to their babies. Joe Palca.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, February 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN Security Council meets this week to consider imposing sanctions on South Sudan.
The government and the opposition do not seem to take the political negotiations seriously, and they appear unwilling to make the necessary compromises.
Hervé Lassus is the United Nations peacekeeping chief. We'll hear from a member of Sudan's opposition while they are boycotting April's parliamentary and presidential elections. The World Health Organization makes a $1 billion appeal for 4 health emergencies, and a new human rights report says conflicts will cause instability in West and Central Africa this year.
2014 was quite a difficult and depressing year in the region, like in many parts of the world. And there's quite a dangerous situation for 2015, quite a lethal cocktail of conflict, of oppression and impunity.
Steve Cockburn is Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for Western Central Africa. The Somali community in Minnesota says it condemns Al-Shabaab's threat to bomb U.S. shopping centers. And a generic drug of Merck drug is approved for HIV. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's post and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. United Nations Security Council will begin discussing imposing sanctions on South Sudan this week as the two sides in the conflict look no closer to a peace deal. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir has more.
South Sudan has been in a cycle of violence for more than a year after a political rivalry between the country's president Salva Kiir and his vice president Riek Machar deteriorated into open fighting that has left thousands dead and displaced nearly 2 million people, causing a catastrophic humanitarian crisis. UN peacekeeping chief Hervé Ladsous told the 15-nation council Tuesday that both sides are continuing to mobilize and bring in new recruits, and he expressed frustration with the failure of peace talks to reach a deal.
The government and the opposition do not seem to take the political negotiations seriously, and they appear unwilling to make the necessary compromises.
Security arrangements and constitutional reforms, and that the probability that either side will soften its position is low. The Security Council has been threatening to impose sanctions since November, but held off as regional group IGAD tried to mediate a peace. As those talks continue to go nowhere, the Council has taken the first step toward imposing sanctions. Diplomats said the United States circulated a draft resolution Tuesday among members aimed at laying the legal groundwork for sanctions. The proposed resolution, seen by VOA, sets out the criteria for individuals and entities who could be sanctioned, including those who contribute to the conflict, obstruct reconciliation, violate human rights, or block humanitarian aid efforts. The draft measure seeks to punish spoilers with travel bans and asset freezes. It also establishes a 5-member panel of experts that would gather information on possible individuals or entities to be sanctioned. What is not clear is whether the Council will impose an arms embargo. In its current form, the draft says the Council would consider any sanctions that would be appropriate to respond to the situation, which could include an arms embargo. Human Rights Watch's UN Director Philippe Bolopion welcomed the proposed resolution, telling VOA that Council action is long overdue.
It's a positive step, and we hope that Security Council members, in particular Russia and China, will quickly go along and send a powerful signal in the country that there will now be a cost to be paid for continued attacks on civilians.
South Sudan's envoy, Francis Deng, tried to discourage consideration of sanctions, telling the Council that they would create an adversarial relationship and aggravate the situation. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A Sudanese opposition leader says his and other major political parties are boycotting the April presidential and parliamentary elections because President Omar al-Bashir's ruling National Congress Party controls everything in the country. Hassan Osman Rizik, deputy president of the opposition Reform Now Movement Party, said under such circumstances, the election will not be free and fair. This comes after President Bashir's party launched its campaign yesterday, Tuesday. Sudan's Information Minister Ahmed Bilal says if the opposition believes in democracy, then it must take part in the election. But Rizik says there is no freedom in Sudan, especially with so many opposition leaders in prison.
Our party is not taking part in election. We are boycotting with all or most the opposition parties. We are not going to participate in this election because these elections are not fair, are not free. They are not recognized by all the internal opposition, and they are not recognized also by the international community. And it will not be fair because the government is also controlling everything. They are ruling in the central government, and they are controlling the state governments, and they are in charge of the money, and they are also using the armed forces and police forces and security forces. It's very difficult to compete with the ruling party in such elections.
I spoke with the government's information minister, Ahmed Bilal, and he said that you, the opposition, you are hurting yourself because election in Sudan is democracy and you need to take part if you want to make a difference.
It is not like that. We sat with the government and we signed two important documents. One is the roadmap for the national dialogue and the other is Addis Ababa Agreement. In these papers, we agreed that the elections must be negotiated and agreed upon with all parties in Sudan. And after that, it must be one of the national dialogue output.
President Barack Obama of the United States, last week, eased on some sanctions on Sudan that will allow some communication equipment to be sold to Sudan. What do you think?
These sanctions are not lifted because Ahmadinejad visited America. They were lifted because many people and many societies asked the American government to lift these sanctions because these sanctions are put on the Sudanese people and are not smart sanctions put on the government of Sudan. Sudanese people are suffering many from some sanctions, such as sanctions lifted by the United States a few days ago. And we hope that also they will lift the other sanctions which hurt and harm the Sudanese people under the government of Sudan.
Now, the government has in jail some opposition people who signed the agreement with the rebels. What is your view on that?
Well, we are against that, of course. We ask for the release of all the political detainees. There must be no single political detainee in prison.
Hassan Osman Rizek is the deputy president of the opposition Reform Now Movement Party. He was speaking with me from the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. A lethal cocktail of conflict risks causing instability this year in Western Central Africa, says Amnesty International's deputy regional director for Western Central Africa, Steve Cockburn. The human rights organization is launching its annual report today, Wednesday. Cockburn talks to Ricky Stryak about pressing human rights violations currently taking place in both Gambia and the Central African Republic, and about upcoming elections throughout the region that pose potential threats to freedom of expression and more.
2014 was quite a difficult and depressing year in the region, like in many parts of the world. And there's quite a dangerous situation for 2015, quite a lethal cocktail of conflict, of oppression and impunity that does risk causing instability in 2015, especially in a year when there are so many quite sensitive elections happening in the region.
First of all, I wanted to ask about Gambia. What, I guess, is the latest in regards to the people who had been subjected to imprisonment for being accused of plotting the attempted coup against Yahya Jammeh? I know some of the relatives of the accused plotters had been imprisoned.
See, obviously, Gambia's had a context of oppression for the last few years, and it's got very much worse over the last 2 years with the introduction of new legislation cracking down on journalists and making it harder to speak out. You know, there's been a lot of movement over the last couple of years, a lot of changes. There's been also new legislation on LGBT communities there who've been repressed and arrested and threatened with torture. Certainly, since the failed coup d'etat, the situation seems to have gotten worse. We documented at least 30 people who'd been arrested, family members of the alleged coup plotters in January. Some of those seem to have been released now, but there's still a decent number of those who remain in custody. They do not have access to lawyers. They don't have access to their families. One of the key things that was agreed by Gambia and by the UN is it would be an investigation into the circumstances of the attempted coup d'etat in December. What we were looking for really is to make sure that that investigation also looks into what happened after the coup d'etat in terms of the arbitrary arrest and the detention, and to make sure the investigators also have access to detention facilities and we can find out what happened to these people, because although we know some have been released, there's still many, many who remain behind bars and we don't have news of them.
A lot of global attention, I feel like, is not being paid to Central African Republic at this time, but the conflict is very much not over, especially in the rural parts of the country.
The conflict, I mean, in some ways it's less intense than perhaps was in January or February in 2014, but it's very, very much still there. The conflict, there's continued fighting.
That was Steve Cockburn, Amnesty International's Deputy Regional Director for West and Central Africa. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal. Today is Wednesday, February 25th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington, and still to come, Mark Oldman's post and our Black History and African History Facts of the Day. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. The Somali American community in the U.S. state of Minnesota says it strongly condemns a threat by the Al-Shabaab terrorist group to attack the Mall of America and other shopping centers in Canada. The condemnation came after a meeting in Minneapolis on Monday. Jelani Hussein, head of the Minnesota branch of the Council of American Islamic Relations, says the security of Minnesota and all of America is important to the Somali American community.
This is very similar to the other threats that we've seen in the past. We believe that this is a last resort by this organization that has already been losing ground in Somalia as well as recruitment efforts here. And therefore, we wanted to make sure that there's no backlash to the Somali American community. Therefore, we as a community, we condemned threats of others as well.
Has the community met and discussed about this new video?
Leaders did, and that's why they came together to draft the statements of strong condemnations.
Explain to me exactly the kind of condemnation that you have issued.
The Somali American community condemned in the strongest most terms the threat by Al-Shabaab, a terror group, against the Mall of America. They believe that the security of Minnesotans and all America is most important to the Somali American community. They also believe that we need to be vigilant. We cannot allow a terror group to spread fear and panic in our community. And we want to make sure that even though there is justifiable security concerns, that's not a pretext to prejudice or hatred or even suspicion of a whole community. And according to the law enforcement agencies, this threat is not being taken as imminent, but rather just a general threat.
And is that how you are taking this, as a general threat rather than imminent, real, direct threat?
I mean, that's what the law enforcement agencies have said themselves. As a community here, we believe that this organization has lost its strength a long time ago, and this is a last ploy to get themselves to be relevant again. And we believe that it's important for the king to be vigilant, but also at the same time be also aware of what's happening, not only through this organization, but ISIS and others as well.
Jelani Hussein is the head of the Minnesota branch of the Council of American Islamic Relations. He spoke with reporter Haroon Maruf of VOA Somali Service. The World Health Organization is launching a $1 billion appeal to provide life-saving health services for 21 million people in the Central African Republic, Iraq, South Sudan, and Syria. The UN agency says health conditions in all four countries are deteriorating because raging conflicts that show no signs of abating. Lisa Schlein reports.
The World Health Organization has launched its appeal on behalf of the entire health cluster of more than 30 international humanitarian organizations. The World Health Organization is running a 65% shortfall from last year's multi-million dollar appeal for the Central African Republic, Iraq, South Sudan, and Syria. It warns continued lack of support will have dire consequences for tens of millions of people. Most of the money, $687 million, will go for Syria, where 12.2 million people need humanitarian health support. WHO country representative for Syria, Elizabeth Hoff, says one of the biggest challenges is reaching people with aid.
People have more difficulties to cope, particularly with the winter season, with a high number of respiratory diseases. But what is the main fear that WHO has as we are moving forward is really the risk of waterborne diseases.
Nearly $219 million is needed to provide humanitarian health support for 4 million people in Iraq, more than half internally displaced by the IS onslaught. The country has been plagued by health crises since the first Gulf War two decades ago. The agency is asking for $90 million to provide health care for 3.35 million people in South Sudan. WHO country representative Tarande Constant Manzila says getting to inaccessible areas will be very expensive.
Last year, for example, in 2014, we counted more than 300 UNHAS flights from out of Juba to deliver services and goods in the many states in more than 80 locations. The money is needed today for the purchase and the prepositioning of all the medical supply and also mounting operation to continue delivering health services during the rainy season, which is going to start at the end of May.
The WHO reports nearly 1.5 million people are in need of health support in the Central African Republic, and $48 million is required to provide services, including vaccinating children against measles and other killer disease. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new licensing agreement with the pharmaceutical company Merck allows for the manufacture of a generic version of a pediatric AIDS drug. It may be 2 years before it's readily available in low- and middle-income countries. However, it's a step towards having greater access to HIV medicines specifically designed for children. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
It's estimated there are more than 3 million children living with HIV, but less than a third of them received antiretroviral therapy in 2013. The UN-backed medicines patent pool estimates 700 children are newly infected each day, while 500 die of AIDS-related causes. The Merck drug, raltegravir, has been approved for children as young as 4 weeks. Medicines patent pool executive director Greg Perry says pediatric AIDS drugs are a neglected area of health care. As a result, many kids with HIV are forced to take adult formulations of antiretroviral pills, or ARVs.
They will taste incorrect. They will have high alcohol content. They will be too big. The children won't take them. So there's a whole series of problems with using adult formulations. And finally, worst of all, of course, is that when you try and break them down, they're not really perfectly digestible to the children or working properly into the bloodstream.
He explains what the licensing agreement with Merck will do.
It does allow really two things. It allows the generic companies to develop and then manufacture low-cost versions of raltegravir. It also enables them to make improvements upon the product.
Currently, the drug is considered a third line of defense. But Perry says there are discussions about using it as a first or second line drug.
It's an important alternative to current sort of preferred product, which is called lopinavir ritonavir. So from a public health point of view, it's an important product.
Perry says it's important to have a wide variety of ARVs in the event HIV builds up resistance to current treatment. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with cricket. West Indies beat Zimbabwe by 73 runs in Group B action at the ICC Cricket World Cup in Canberra, Australia on Tuesday. In athletics, the Sanlam Cape Town Marathon has been granted the IAAF Silver Road Race status. The race ambassador and former World Half Marathon record holder Ilana Meyer disclosed in Cape Town, South Africa on Tuesday. The Cape Town Marathon is the second in Africa to secure IAAF status. The Okpekpe 10-kilometer road race in Edo State, South Nigeria, attained IAAF bronze status last October. The third edition of the annual Okpekpe 10-kilometer race is scheduled for the 2nd of May, while the 9th edition of the Cape Town Marathon is on the 20th of September. Moving on to football, FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria tackle South Africa in the first semi-final at the Africa Under-17 Championships in Niamey, Niger today, Wednesday. Meanwhile, Kenya's top football players are up in arms over the raging feud between the national football governing body, Football Kenya Federation, FKF, and Kenya Premier League, KPL, the organizers of the country's top flight club competition. FKF and KPL are locked in a bitter battle over who should be in charge of the league. The league is suspended pending a court hearing next month. On Tuesday, leading national team players Arnold Origi, Dennis Oli, and Alan Wanga told the Nairobi media that the deadlock adversely affects players' livelihood. The players gave FKF and KPL a one-week ultimatum to resolve the crisis or they'll stage a street protest to highlight their plight. In Qatar, there are strong indications that the FIFA 2022 World Cup in Qatar will be staged in November and December that year rather than in June and July, as has been the tradition. The FIFA Secretary General Jerome Valks revealed in Doha on Tuesday this proposal change by the FIFA Task Force on International Match Calendar has to be ratified by FIFA Executive Committee next month. The proposed switch is calculated to avoid the period from May to September when Qatar experiences its hottest weather conditions. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 25th. On this day in 1870, Hiram Rebels of Mississippi was sworn in as the first black U.S. senator and representative in Congress. Also on this day in 1948, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was ordained as a Baptist minister. On this day in 1964, Muhammad Ali or Cassius Clay became the world heavyweight boxing champion when he defeated Sonny Liston at the end of the sixth round in Miami, Florida. Also on this day in 1989, Mike Tyson became the undisputed heavyweight boxing champion of the world by defeating challenger Frank Bruno of England. On this day in 1978, General Daniel Chappie James, the first African-American four-star general, died in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And today in Black History, we want to tell you about Emmett W. Chappelle, recipient of 14 U.S. patents and recognized as one of the 100 most distinguished African-American scientists and engineers of the 20th century. Chappelle started with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, in 1966 and pioneered the development of the ingredients ever present in all cellular material. Later, he developed techniques that are still widely used for the detection of bacteria in urine, blood, spinal fluids, drinking water, and food. And in African history, on this day in 1977, 240 U.S. citizens were held hostage in Uganda by Field Marshal Idi Amin Dada. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 25th. Congratulations to Edwin Uhara of Maitama in Abuja, Nigeria, Ibinau William of Limbe, Southwest Region of Cameroon, and William Kokulu of Monrovia, Liberia. You are the winners of our February 24th question: which African-American civil rights activist and pan-Africanist was one of the founders of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP? The answer: W.E.B. Du Bois. Now, here is our question for today, February 25th. Who is considered the first African-American woman to receive a degree as a medical doctor? Once again, who is considered the first African-American woman to receive a degree as a medical doctor? Send your answers to DaybreakAfrica at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. And that's it for this Wednesday, February 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington saying, have a lovely day, Africa. Some people say we got a lot of
with the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.